Hey, y'all, Scott here. I think you ought to consider subscribing to The Future of Freedom, the journal of the Future Freedom Foundation, in print or online. The Future of Freedom features the best writers in the libertarian movement, the fearless Jacob Hornberger, individualist anarchist Sheldon Richman, and crusading journalist Jim Bovard, along with Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Tim Kelly, Richard Ebling, and many more. And the July issue features one by your favorite radio host on America's Middle East policy, entitled Stupidity or the Plan. So head on over to fff.org/subscribe and sign up for The Future of Freedom in print or online. That's fff.org/subscribe and tell them Scott sent you.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is the Scott Horton Show. We're at scotthorton.org, noagendastream.com, talkstreamlive.com, and things like that. All right, our first guest on the show today is Mike Swanson. You just heard my spot for his site, wallstreetwindow.com. Hey, Mike, how the hell are you?
Oh, I'm doing good, Scott. Good to talk to you.
Very good to have you here. And this is no kind of, paid infomercial spot or anything like that. I just want to interview you about stuff because you write these great articles, and I should be interviewing you about them all the time anyway.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Good stuff here, yeah. So, which one? This is the one that I was really interested in. A lot of different points to go over here, and you know how it works. We got plenty of time to do it, too.
Sure.
Traders excited over stock market, but this economy is not creating good jobs. So, well, I don't know. What the hell exactly does that mean anyway? Because TV says that things are looking up.
Well, you got two things going on there. And one, of course, is the stock market has gone up the past couple years. A lot of it having to do with the fact that the Federal Reserve is doing this quantitative easing policy of financing the deficit and printing debt and maintaining super low interest rates. And if you think back to the last decade, Alan Greenspan did the same thing in the 90s, and that helped create the internet bubble. That crashed, and they did create another bubble to bail that bubble out. The housing bubble, it crashed. Now we're creating a new bubble. But I think this bubble is government debt, and that's much more dangerous down the road. And I think, you know, we're at a point where there's a hidden factor in there, which I've talked about, and that's the military budget. Because without controlling that, I don't think they can control the deficit anymore.
Mm-hmm. All right, now... Well, let's stick with that for a minute. I guess where Robert Higgs and Mother Jones and the National Priorities Project all come together and agree that it's approximately $1 trillion a year blown on militarism, that must be right about correct, huh?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And one way they get to that figure, though, is that they're also looking at the interest that past wars and past military spending has created that we have to finance it. So the actual military budget isn't exactly $1 trillion. You know, the impact of the budgets before that, it adds up to $1 trillion. And one thing that's amazing to me is, you know, these are all issues, you know, I've read Higgs and the other people. I listen to your show and, you know, interested, of course, in the economy and all this stuff. But we don't really realize, I don't think, the impact of military spending because we don't really – see it. For example, if you look at the jobs issue in the United States, most of the jobs that are being created now are low-pay, real retail and restaurant jobs and a lot of part-time jobs. So they're not really, you know, great jobs that are stimulating consumer spending in a big way or anything like that. But one thing that's fascinating, and I didn't know this, is that if you go in a Walmart, at the beginning of the month, you see all these people, you know, having to use food stamps and going in there. And a lot of people see these people and think, well, they're the ones contributing to the deficit and their problem, never mind, in the economy. But in reality, most people are working. I know lots of people who work for the sheriff department that actually get food stamps because they don't make enough money if they have children and families. And then the thing that's really shocking, though, to me, is that the biggest employer in the United States is the Defense Department. They employ 3 million people. So in a certain sense, I think the economy that the regular person lives in is bad right now. It's been bad for years, and the job situation's bad. And we're actually propping up the defense establishment and suffering for it at this point.
All right, now, with my limited imagination and economic knowledge, I'm thinking that if we abolished the empire and fired all our soldiers and our 3 million Pentagon employees, well, then, hell, like, yeah, that would drive wages down even more. That would cause a gigantic glut in labor, and everybody would be out of a job.
Yeah, well, that's an argument. However, I remember last year, and actually, that's an argument. I don't know if you're familiar with the book. What's it called? It was written in the 60s. It had Iron Mountain in the title. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, yeah. The report of the committee from Iron Mountain. Yeah.
And
it was. They always argue whether it was really meant to be a satire or not. But either way, it's great.
Yeah, yeah. It's a great little book. And one of the arguments in that book.
It's about on the desirability of peace, and the whole thing is, if peace is not desirable at all, how do we keep conflict going? That's what it's about.
Yeah, and the argument. The reason they say you need to have war or a war-based society is, one, to hold people together, justify having a state, and second, for the economy. And that book's argument was that that inflation is a problem in the economy, and if you can just take people's money and just basically put it into a useless thing, which is what I would say the defense budget is, once it gets past a certain point, you know. For example, if you take an F-22 airplane and they cost $150 million a piece, and they don't really have a purpose in the wars we're fighting, they're just like a waste. So you could argue, well, that's great because that money could create inflation or something. However, you know, that gets much as baloney. But the other argument.
Yeah, too much wealth in this society is what creates inflation, huh?
Yeah,
so that's why we
exactly.
have to destroy wealth.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of crazy. But the other argument is, well, it's a great jobs program. And that was essentially, if you think back to last year during the presidential election, that was sort of an argument being made then. And they sent, if I remember correctly, the Romney people sent these letters off saying people could lose their jobs if he doesn't win. Of course, none of that happened. The defense industry is going to lay people off. And I remember reading some studies at the time saying that, well, the amount of money it costs to create one of these jobs is so much, is like $80,000 or $100,000 to create like a $30,000 or $40,000 job, that it's not cost effective if you're just trying to create jobs for people. So probably is a better way. You know, if you just want to employ these 3 million people to get them to do something else. And I think even more important is that to really have sustainable economic growth and a real boom in the economy, you really need to see capital investment among private companies that want to, you know, invest in new technologies or expand their businesses. And that'll trickle over into hiring people in a sustainable way, in a productive way that contributes to the economy. And one thing that's happening is that because interest rates are so low and there's so much government debt being created, it's crowding out private investment. In fact, I was looking the other day at projections some economists are making that private capital investment's going to decline next year. Well, that's, you know, you don't want that kind of thing going on for a healthy economy. So all this military spending and the debt to finance it has a negative impact also on the private marketplace.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's funny the way you described at the beginning of the interview about how, well, remember in the 90s we had this prosperity, but then it was this dot-com and, you know, the NASDAQ and Dow bust of 99 and 2000, and then we did it again, and everybody thought they were rich for a minute, or not everybody, but a lot of people anyway, thought they were rich for a minute, refinancing their house a couple times and getting a new car and whatever, whatever, and then that all came to a terrible, abrupt end with this boom and bust. And now you're telling me that the gains in the stock market and these kinds of things are just another one of these kind of fake bubbles. But here's the thing. So what would it take to just have real growth instead of all these dislocations? You're saying it's the military spending, that without the military spending, we wouldn't have these dislocations? We could just have maybe slow and steady real growth of actual wealth and production and higher standards of living?
Well, I don't think it's really the defense spending that's the cause. It's the Federal Reserve creating all this debt, which is going into the Defense Department. You know, it's being used to fund it. But I can't just say it's just the defense industry. It's really the Fed enabling it and the impact of, you know, trying to manipulate interest rates and prevent recessions. That's the real problem. Is it's not something that's necessarily, you know, just starting now, but I think over the past, since the early 80s or 1987 or so, where the Fed decided that we don't want to see, you know, major stock market declines or recessions or anything, and we're just going to try to prevent it, or else it also, there's evidence that they, Alan Greenspan and some of the people around him became terrified that after the 1987 stock market crash, that if the economy, if the market crashed too much, everything will just like stop, which is kind of a, it's actually not something to be as scared of as they were. There's a beneficial effect to having recessions and temporary slowdowns in the economy. It causes people to get more conservative, and those that are too much in debt, you know, pay their debts off. Companies that are, don't need to be in business or too over leveraged or whatnot, they get beat by competition and so forth. The problem is that they keep, over the past couple of decades, they've kept trying to prevent this from happening. And as a result, each bubble and each crisis, you build up more imbalances, and each one has become worse than the last one.
Right, but then so at some point, how bad does it have to get for us to really liquidate all the bad debts and have a real, you know, an economy based on sound investments? Because when people talk about, I guess, just number losses, maybe more trillions were lost in the crash of 08 and all that kind of thing. But in the Great Depression, people starved to death, and they didn't sit at home on unemployment. They literally could not find a single thing to do for a dime. For a long time, right? So we don't want it to get, and that's the monetarist argument. That's the Bernanke argument, that we have to keep inflating because we can't let it get that low. And even if you're right, I don't think he would say this part, but even if you're right that we screwed up by inflating too many bubbles in a row now, then, but now it's really true that we can't let it crash all the way down, because think of the dislocations that would come from that. Think of the harm to people that would come from that. So we have to keep inflating.
Well, I'd like to make one interesting point in a second about that. But one thing is, it is terrible. You know, the Depression was terrible. And if you look in the 1800s, there are also multiple depressions that took place. But the difference between the ones that happened then and the Great Depression, or even the situation now, is that you didn't have all this intervention on the part of the central bank. So they tended to be very quick in duration, you know, just 6 months or a year. There's, I don't know how monetary history in the 1800s, I mean, I'm not trying to claim to be an expert in it, but for example, there's one in the 1880s after Andrew Jackson, his second term, I think it was towards the end of it, there was one. But if you look right now overseas, there's a crisis going on in Cyprus and Greece. There's one building in Argentina. They happen all the time, you know, and they're not the end of the world when they do happen, and things recover and stabilize and you get a boom. Normally they just last about a year, but it's state intervention that makes them drawn out. You can read Murray Rothbard's book, The Great Depression, for that argument, too, for the 30s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in fact, well, it often happens that Rothbard gives, I guess, different levels of explanation of the business cycle, but the way he explains it in that one is, I think, real easy for the layman. And also the chapter on it in, and I mean, this is just for the newbies. The people who already know, they know where to look, too. But in the manifesto, Libertarian Manifesto for a New Liberty, the explanation of the Austrian school theory of the business cycle in there is also, you know, very well done and very accessible to people not familiar, too. But yeah, no, I'm with you. I'm just trying to play devil's advocate a little bit because,
sure.
Of course,
well, let me give you another argument that almost no one has ever heard.
All right.
and to justify what the Fed's doing, to argue against what I just said. In 2009, there's an issue of foreign affairs, which is put out by the Council of Foreign Relations. It's probably the most prestigious, you know, foreign policy think tank in the United States. And this issue had a headline article at the Quarterly Journal, and this one had a really important article. The headline article was, I can't remember the title of it, but it was written by Peter Peterson, who is one of the top people in that organization, and he talks about, you know, debt, deficits, and all this kind of business. And the question of the article was, is America in decline? Are these debts going to, you know, harm the country? And he was projecting that by 2030 it would, if nothing is done, that there'd be some sort of financial crisis. And he was using the government congressional budget data. Now, his argument, though, was what we should do to prevent this from happening is raise taxes and lower people's standard of living so that the United States will import less goods, you know, we'll buy less stuff, create overseas, so the financing of our trade deficit won't have to be so big. And the bottom line is he was basically saying, we can't make any major changes because to do that would mean dismantling the empire and lowering military spending.
Yeah, Lord knows we can't do that. Just forget that.
Yeah, we can't do that. So the only other choice, and this is what he was arguing, was just lower everyone's standard of living. You know, we'll have inflation and we'll have higher taxes and people just have to, you know, be used to living at a lower standard of living. And no one has ever read that. I was like, this is amazing, you know, to read stuff like that in print being advocated. And I was just like, wow. You know?
Well, and he sure as hell didn't mean anybody on Park Avenue that they would have to reduce their standard of living. That's where Pratt House is.
Oh, is it? Is it?
Yeah, that's CFR headquarters there in Manhattan.
But I don't know. I kind of wonder if sometimes that's kind of the direction the country's going in. I'll go.
You know, I had a teacher back in the early 1990s who said, you know, I've been around the world, this, that, the other thing, and there are countries where you have the very rich people live in the high rises and everybody else lives in the slums, and that's it, and there is no middle class, and that's the way America's going. So pick your side and fight for it, but you know, that's what's going on now is the billionaires have decided to abolish the thousandaires. They want everyone on paycheck to paycheck.
It seems like that. Well, yeah, to give you an example or a little story, the place I live in, it's a town of about, or a city of about 50,000 people, and I live in Southern Virginia, and it's a very depressed area because a lot of factories have shut down, and in fact, I was looking at some statistics, and out of 260 cities in the United States, if you rank them by per capita income, it's like 238, and the household income is like $17,000. And half the people, you know, are on assistance if they have children. Well, I was in the city, and it's also a rural county surrounding it, and I was on someone's farmland a few months ago, and two F-22 fighter planes flew over us. And they're only about 1,000 feet up in there, and they're real, you know, fancy looking and impressive. And they come by this area every once in a while because they fly to Norfolk and they're doing training exercises. Well, I've looked on the internet, and one of those planes cost $150 million. So that was $300 million of money that was spent to make these planes fly above us. And the whole area I live in, the whole retail sales in any given year doesn't even amount to that much money. So it's just amazing to think that that's the size of day-to-day life in stores or, you know, going to the grocery store, people I know, whatever, is for the whole area is dwarfed by those two airplanes.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm kind of reminded of that mean old Bill Lind years ago on this show. And I say that kind of in jest, but he was saying, oh, forget it. Yeah, no, just throw it in the trash. The whole thing's over. It's a free-for-all. It's an imperial court. And what that means is no one is really in charge. It's simply a matter of who can take over the Congress enough to exploit the state enough that they have the ability to reach into the honeypot and take for themselves. It's a zero-sum game, and the race is on. Who can use the government to cannibalize the entire country for their own personal benefit at the expense of everybody else, and there ain't a damn thing in the world that can be done to stop them now.
Well, one thing, too, is it could be that I'm giving too much. We're giving too much credit to these, you know, elites and people in charge or whatnot. You know, it's one thing to plan things out and another thing to actually do what you're trying to do. And a lot of times, you know, if you look at history, when power gets really, really super concentrated and you get these big divisions in society, usually at some point the people at the top don't even know what they're doing.
Right.
And they can.
Yeah, I mean, that was his point, I think. Yeah, no one is in charge.
Okay.
It's just a
it's
a free-for-all. It's a contest between bankers, farmers, arms merchants, old people, and pill pushers, and a few other of the most powerful interests, maybe mining interests or something, and oil companies. And then, but they just, they're willing to completely, you know, to take everything if they can. You know, there's no, there's not the slightest bit of what's good for anyone else.
Right, so you could have like the Peter Peterson guy writing his foreign affairs article saying, oh, we can, here's the crisis of 2030 and we're just going to keep things going like this. But what if he's wrong, you know, and there actually is problems in 5 years or 8 years or something and everything blows up before he ever thinks. So
right.
You just don't know what will happen. No, no one can predict the future like that. So.
Well, now, so let me ask you about this.
Okay.
You know, you are, as far as I know, very successful at this whole investing thing and trying to predict the future the best you can. So there's something that's been a discrepancy, which is that the people who best explained the bubble and predicted its popping, the Austrian school libertarian types in the last decade, many of their leaders, anyway, predicted a pretty widespread price inflation. And I know they underestimate CPI as much as they can, and they finagle the numbers as best they can. But it seems like rather than having any kind of anything like a hyperinflation, there's the buildup of these bubbles, like we've talked about. But all this, you know, we have to bail out Wall Street so they can save Main Street, like you've talked about. That hasn't happened. The standard of living of the regular people has gone down. The best job they can get is McDonald's or Walmart or the Army. Or the temp service, Kelly Services here, as you say in your article.
Yeah.
And so, but so I wonder, where's all the price inflation? Is it, and when I ask, I'll go ahead and say one more thing about that. When I ask them about that, say Bob Murphy or Mark Thornton, they say, well, the thing is that Bernanke, I guess, got smart and he pays the banks an interest rate now to keep the money that he's bailed them out with at the Fed and not loan it out. But there's no law that says they can't loan it out. It's just such a bad bet to loan it out right now that they're making a better return by keeping it at the Fed for just 2% or whatever it is. But that someday all that money still could be loaned out, or if confidence in the dollar overseas really gets much worse and all those dollars really start floating home, then we'll see that hyperinflation. But basically they've been able to use bubble gum and string to put off the consequences that are still coming due. And I just wonder what you think of that. And
yeah,
I may be paraphrasing everyone terribly, so any error is mine.
I know them fellas, actually. it's complicated in the sense that, you know, in 2002, that's when I first actually knew them. And if you look from 2002 till today, there has been inflation. You know, gold has gone up, and oil prices have gone up. But there's been nothing like any sort of hyperinflation like you know, they were predicting what happened, or some people predicted. And I remember back then, in those couple years before 2008, I was reading stuff about the current account deficit. And it was articles saying, and that's sort of like our trade deficits, the amount of money we borrow from overseas to finance it. And it, they, these articles are saying that when that gets to 5%, you get a crisis, a financial crisis. So I was reading that thinking to myself, well, hey, no wonder why gold's going up, and I guess the dollar's going to blow up one day, right? And then in 2008, the crisis came, and that didn't happen. The dollar went up, actually, and gold crashed. And the point is that you can't really – it's interesting because you can see things coming on the horizon, but you can't really predict exactly – how they're going to play out or whatnot, and they could still be proven correct in the end. You know, I think sort of maybe that was just an interruption, and the real crisis is coming down the road. But I don't.
Yeah, after all, there were a bazillion dollars worth of bad bets that still needed to be liquidated. That are being liquidated.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's sort of a breakdown in the whole fractional reserve system. People aren't taking out loans. And the banks aren't loaning money or that much anyway, I guess. I don't really know. Is that right?
But
they'll only
right.
loan money to you if you're Walmart.
Yeah, basically. Or you got like a perfect balance sheet with the assets already on it. And you don't really need the money. But, yeah.
But so, in other words, they're not taking risks on new entrepreneurs right now because they're still looking at a bear market.
Well, not just that, but it's hard for them to make money. You know, if you're a bank and you are putting money out for these low interest rates, it's hard to justify taking big risks too. So I mean, I think that if the rates went up, it would actually have a somewhat of a stimulative effect, as long as they didn't go up so high that it caused the government to have trouble financing its debt. Now, I think that's the potential for real problems if that ever happens. But even that won't necessarily lead to, you know, a total hyperinflation disaster.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm against all welfare programs because I'm an abolitionist and I'm against the state altogether. And I really don't like the state bribing people into liking it by taking care of their basic needs and stuff like that, especially. But on the other hand, it's the very last part of the government that I would abolish. And I really like it when libertarians point out that the food stamp budget, as you write it here, $88 billion, that's nothing compared to what they spend on killing people, what they spend on bailing out bankers, what they spend on reading all our emails and tapping all our phone calls, violating all of our rights. So the people who demagogue against the poor and the dependent, you know, are really missing the boat there. It's those with the power are the ones who are really getting all the money. I really like it when people who have money notice that, you know. Anyway,
yeah,
we got to go.
It.
Thanks, Mike, so much for sponsoring the show and your time on the show.
Yeah, thanks.
Great to talk to you. Mike Swanson, everybody, WallStreetWindow.com. We'll be right back.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Are you sick of the neocons and the Israel lobby pretending as though they've earned some kind of monopoly on foreign policy wisdom in Washington, D.C.? These PNAC clowns who've never been right about anything? Well, the Council for the National Interest is pushing back, putting America first, and telling the lobby to go take a hike. The empire's bad enough without the neocons making it all about the interests of a foreign state. Help CNI promote peace. Visit their site at councilforthenationalinterest.org and click donate under About Us at the top of the page. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new project, Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com. They've got two new audiobooks read by the deepest voice in libertarianism, the great historian Jeff Riggenbach. Our Last Hope,
Rediscovering the Lost Path to Liberty by Michael Meharry of the 10th Amendment Center is available now. And Beyond Democracy, co-authored by Frank Karsten of the Mises Institute Netherlands and journalist Carl Beckman, will be released this month. And they're only just getting started. So check out listenandthink.com. You may be able to get your first audiobook absolutely free. That's Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com.
Hey, all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at libertystickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at libertystickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at thebumpersticker.com. Libertystickers.com. Everyone else is stickers suck.
Oh man, I'm late. Sure hope I can make my flight.
Stand there.
Me? I am standing here.
Come here.
Okay.
Hands up, turn around.
Whoa, easy.
Into the scanner.
Ooh, what's this in your pants?
Hey, slow down. It's just my...
Hold it right there. Your wallet has tripped the metal detector. What's this? The Bill of Rights?
That's right. It's just a harmless stainless steel business card-sized copy of the Bill of Rights from SecurityEdition.com. There for exposing the TSA as a bunch of liberty-destroying goons who've never protected anyone from anything. Sir, now give me back my wallet and get out of my way. Got a plane to catch.
Have a nice day.
Play a leading role in the security theater with the Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. It's the size of a business card, so it fits right in your wallet, and it's guaranteed to trip the metal detectors wherever the police state goes. That's SecurityEdition.com. And don't forget their great Fourth Amendment socks.
Hey, guys, I got his laptop.